Hello, Radioland, Podcastville, and all the ships at sea. My name is Seth Greenland, and you are listening to the LARB Radio Hour, brought to you by reader-supported Los Angeles Review of Books. Today on our show, Los Angeles author Nina Revor visits us at the International LARB headquarters to tell us about her fifth novel, Lost Canyon. LARB editor Sarah Messley explains the concept of mansplaining to Tom and me. Lori presumably already knows what it is. John Powers is here to resurrect the reputation of forgotten Hollywood novelist Alfred Hayes.
I'd never heard of him. Had you ever heard of him?
I had never heard of him. Juan Felipe Herrera, who is not only a friend of Lar, but happens to be the poet laureate of the United States, is here to read a poem by Philip Levine. And B.J. Novak was here last week, but he left with Catherine Taylor, presumably to hear more about her new book. We called his agent and straightened it out, and he's consented to come back this week, so he'll be on the show later. Joining me, as usual, are my co-hosts, the Professor Tom Lutz. Hello, Tom.
Grüezi.
And she's a critic. She is a journalist. She's an expert on Oscar Hammerstein and everything the Nazis ever did. Lori Weiner. Hello, Lori.
Ni hao.
Author Nina Revor has written five books. Her fifth is Lost Canyon. She's here today to talk about it. Hello, Nina.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the book is about a group of urban people who venture into the wilderness where they basically toast marshmallows, sing birthday songs, and come out, and everything's fine, right?
Not exactly. Not exactly.
Not exactly.
I think it's a kind of a compilation of things that can go wrong. And someone asks, how wrong? And I think the right answer is very wrong.
What is your background in interfacing with the wilderness or hiking or, you know, mountaineering? Or
I'm an avid hiker. I'd say I'm probably an intermediate backpacker, and I'm a neophyte and wannabe mountaineer. But I do spend a lot of time hiking, not only in the local mountains here in Los Angeles, but more in the Sierras.
Which is where the book is set.
Absolutely, yes.
Did the book come to you while you were camping, while you were outside? Is that when it occurred to you, the plot, most of it?
Or? Well, yes. I'd actually been working on another book for about 2 years, and it was a historical novel that also had something to do with the mountains. And it was one of those times when you're working on something and it's not quite, you know, gelling. And I was literally on a hike at about 10,000 feet up in the Sierras, and I was thinking, why am I working on this rather obscure historical novel when I could be talking about the immediacy of what I feel right now? And so I ditched that project and just put it in a shelf. And then I came back to Los Angeles, where I started yearning for and missing the mountains I had been in. And I thought, how do I create a contemporary book that captures the kinds of things I feel when I'm outside?
Let's get back to the book in a second, but I'd want to take that occasion to ask about Southland, because it is the 50th anniversary of the Watts riots, right? You have written a series of historical novels, including one about the Watts riots.
Yes. Southland follows a group of characters, Japanese-American and African-American characters, through several decades of Los Angeles history, the 30s, the 40s, 50s, leading up to the Watts riots in the 1960s. I do tend to take a step away from my subject. So my first couple books I wrote about Los Angeles, I wrote about them when I wasn't living here. And somehow having that distance gave me the perspective or the sense of yearning that I needed to create that fictional world. And so that's part of why I have, in the past, always done historical books. You know, I have a book that was set in Los Angeles in the 1920s, in the silent film era. And I wrote that while I was here, but writing from almost a century's distance gave me the perspective I needed to write with a sense of yearning.
Mm-hmm. And this is normal, right? I mean, Walter Mosley's LA novels are all written in New York.
Yeah, maybe so. I've always had a hard time writing about a place when I'm actually in it. You know, it's kind of like trying to write a love letter to someone who's sitting in the room with you.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've always thought of you as an Angeleno, because my thinking is totally circumscribed and I've only known you here. Mm-hmm. But where are you from originally?
Well, I was actually born in Japan. Uh-huh. I lived there till I was five. And then I lived in Wisconsin for a few years in my early childhood. And actually, my last book was set in rural Wisconsin, in an area close, similar to where I lived.
What was it about Los Angeles that lit up your imagination and made it attractive to you as a locus for literary work?
Part of it is simply that coming to LA, and sometimes when you are not born in a place and you come to it, you fall in love with it almost harder. So once I was here, I felt a familiarity. I felt a welcoming. I'd been this mixed race kid in Japan where I felt out of place, mixed race kid in rural Wisconsin where I definitely felt out of place, and then came to Los Angeles where I did not feel like such an anomaly. There was such diversity, there was such mixture here. And then when I really started to pay attention, Los Angeles is really a place where everything that's happening nationally is happening here in bold type. You know, whether it's immigration, whether it's the environments, whether it's entertainment, land use, race relations, obviously, police-community relations. And so for a novelist, that is a very ripe place for your imagination.
One of the things about Lost Canyon is that it has much more tightly constructed than your other novels. Maybe it's because of the messiness of history, but this is constructed like a classic thriller. It's got three main characters whose perspectives we follow, and it goes 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, and it really has a feeling of it's formally elegant.
And because my others weren't.
Yeah, exactly. That's why.
That's what we wanted to talk to you about.
You can see it's a straight shot narrative. It doesn't jump back and forth in time.
It doesn't jump.
What are you getting stuck on?
I don't know. As I was reading it, I thought this is a very different kind of novel than the novels you've written in the past. And I don't think it's just because those are historical novels and this is not. Mm-hmm. There's something about the kind of formal elegance of mm-hmm. it that seemed different to me.
I think that came out of the experience of having the failed novel just before it, where I was trying to pull together all of these pieces that weren't fitting. It was frustrating. It was big. It was unwieldy. And so when this came to me, the idea for Lost Canyon, the narrative essentially was just like a slingshot. It just came out so much more quickly and naturally. And so I had read recently As I Lay Dying, and I love the way that each of those changing perspectives and narrators actually built upon each other. So you're never looping back, you're never kind of recreating or layering, you're always moving forward. And so I thought that that would create an interesting kind of momentum where you're not just getting the switching points of view, but that every time you are reading a chapter, it's moving the story forward.
Earlier, you alluded to walking in the Sierra wilderness and being overwhelmed by the beauty and the grandeur, and yet the book is thrillery. It has a lot of thriller elements, and of course, what drives thrillers are anxiety, which is one of my favorite topics. And I would like for you to talk about the tension between absorbing the glory mm-hmm. of the surroundings and yet the infusion of anxiety that's required to deliver the book that you wanted to deliver, and how you kept those two things in balance.
You know, I think that they are actually linked in that one thing that's required for both of them is a sense that you're truly present. And so whether you are really appreciating the beauty or the grandeur of what's around you, or whether you're afraid that you're about to get, you know, caught in a lightning storm or eaten by a mountain lion or all those things, you're really where you are. And there's something that to me it is very, you know, powerful about that. It's very liberating. You know, we tend to live so much in our heads. We tend to lose touch with our bodies. We're linked to our computers. We're linked to our cell phones. And we're constantly thinking about what we should be doing, what we should have done differently. We're not necessarily in the now, or at least I'm not. And when you are out there on a truly spectacular hike, or especially if you're backpacking or mountain climbing, when you literally have to figure out, you know, how do I cross this river, or do I take this trail or that trail, or do I refill my water bottle now or wait until the next stream? There may be consequences to those choices, you know, and particularly if there is something happening like weather, which seems like such a small thing, but if you're caught out there in a thunder and lightning storm, it can be pretty intense. And so you can absolutely feel the sense of grandeur and the sense of anxiety at the same time, and I certainly do.
And it's not just weather that is threatening these characters.
Well, and I think that's an important thing to note, is that often people, you know, worry about going outdoors and are they going to run into a bear? Are they going to run into a mountain lion? Sure, those things are there.
Yes, they are.
But it's really other people who are the biggest danger.
I'm worried, as I keep thinking of things to ask you about, because I'm worried about spoilers. There are moments when a character has just killed somebody and then looks out at the vista and is is blown away by it. Is that going too far?
No, that's fine.
Okay. So there's...
That's called a trailer moment.
And looks out at that vista and is just completely blown away by the beauty that they're beholding.
Well, they're feeling very alive.
Is that how you feel?
Because they're not dead.
Well, and one of the things about being in a truly wild place is that you look up and you look around you, and you realize how small you really are. And for some people, that is a very harrowing experience. And for others, I'm one of them, it's a very comforting one. It just places everything in perspective. If you're worried about your, you know, the argument you just had with your boss, or, you know, paying whatever bill that's 2 days late, no one cares. Who cares about that when there's just this incredible mountain, this incredible landscape, or, you know, river or ocean or whatever it is that floats your boat?
This is the origin of the romantic theory of the sublime, is those Shelley and going to look at the Alps.
Right, exactly. And so many of the early explorers of the Sierras were very influenced by those romantic notions of the wilderness.
Yeah, and by the wilderness itself, of course.
And by the wilderness itself.
Mina Revoir, the book is Lost Canyon. Thanks for coming in to talk to us. I'm Seth Greenland, here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner, here on the LARB Radio Hour, 90.7 FM, KPFK. Obscure Hollywood novels are one of my favorite subjects, especially since I'm the author of one. And our guest, John Powers, is here to hip us to one of his favorites by an author called Alfred Hayes. John.
Yes. Well, Alfred Hayes is an interesting figure. He was born in England, but first made his name, I think, so far as I can tell, in Italy, where he worked with Roberto Rossellini on the film Paisan. Then came to America and Hollywood. He did a Fritz Lang film, Clash by Night. And he did not exist for me until a few months ago. And a French film guy, French film people are more steeped in Hollywood than Americans could ever be. This French film guy was saying, you have to read Alfred Hayes. Or I actually started off, have you read Alfred Hayes? And I said, no, I have not read Alfred Hayes. He said, you must read Alfred Hayes. And he basically gave me that little potted bio and said, he wrote these great novels about Hollywood. As it happened, the NYRB Press had brought out a couple of them. So I bought one called My Face for the World to See. And it is a love story, I guess, between a screenwriter and an aspiring actress. It flies by and you think it's actually not that deep. Yet somehow by the end, this slim novel once again gives you so much of the great, you know, the great screenwriter's self-hatred, which is, I think, you know, the great motif of all
screenwriting novels. Yeah.
Yes. You know, the story flips. So at first, what you think it's about is this kind of woman who might have stepped from the pages of Nathaniel West as this sad actress type. And then gradually you realize it gets more complex. And the title, My Face for the World to See, you're not quite sure whose face it is by the end. And, you know, it's pungent, it's quick. And once again, captures something about the feeling of being here.
And so it should be in the canon of the great Hollywood novels?
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure what the canon of great Hollywood novels is.
Are you making John do something that he's uncomfortable
with? Yeah, I know. John doesn't like to make these kinds of distinctions. But yeah, I mean, there's Nathaniel West. There's Bud Schulberg. There's Bruce Wagner.
Seth Greenland.
Seth Greenland. There's less pop with this than some of those. It's a very good novel. There's more feeling and kind of darkness in it than you would expect. And it's not the gleeful darkness. I think gleeful darkness, you know, I mean, as one who I think earned Bruce Wagner's undying hatred by saying that I threw his first book across the room.
He didn't like that.
He didn't. And yet I would have thought he would have liked that because he likes darkness so much. But certain writers love hell too much. Mm. I think one of the things I don't like about the guy who's writing True Detective is that he digs the misery and horror that he's depicting and tries to pretend he's outside it. Yet there's so much juice mm-hmm. in this stuff whenever something's really nasty. I actually feel the same way about James Ellroy, is that he never likes it better than when somebody's selling somebody out.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
course.
I mean, you know, it's like...
I don't think he'd have a problem with that.
Yeah.
With you saying that. Right?
Oh, no, I don't think... I'm not sure he would...
I think Ellroy would actually like it if you told him you threw his book across the room, too.
But when you read certain of these people, they revel in it. You know, it's that Randall Jarrell line from Pictures in an Institution, which is, so-and-so doesn't just like hell, he's loyal to it. And I think somehow that, like, Wagner's loyal to the hell, you know, and he loves it, you know, both, you know, I like this better.
John Powers, thanks for coming by to tell us about the Alfred Hayes book, My Face for the World to See. There's a concept afoot in the culture lately called mansplaining, which we're going to...
Can you explain that to us, Seth?
I have no idea what it is. But someone who might is Sarah Messley, who's a senior editor at the Los Angeles Review of Books. Sarah, thanks for coming in.
The irony is lost on no one. Very glad to be here.
That's what we specialize in.
But, you know, funnily enough, Tom wanted to explain it, so he's going to jump
in. Thank you, Tom. I'm so interested.
Okay. Mansplaining is the result of the fact that women don't do enough explaining.
It is definitely women's fault.
I think so. That's my theory.
It's really, we should learn more. Can you tell me more about what I should do?
You just have to do your part in the explaining business.
It's like our explaining is too small.
Exactly.
And men's explaining is so big and like too messent.
Well,
and
just because it has to be.
Oh, it's so big.
It's really, you know, yeah.
The explaining, in case the listeners missed that, I want to underline that felicitousness of phrase there. The explaining is too messent. That's excellent, by the way.
Thank you.
So, she's a writer.
I'm glad that you approve.
So in your view,
she's batting her eyes.
In your view, ladies, explain to me what mansplaining. What is mansplaining in your view?
That was a really amazing lead-in, right? The way in which the lead-in sort of fundamentally made anything that I said about my gender and this kind of undermined it, so then you could approve it or not.
Yes, exactly.
That's
right. Yeah.
Kind of mansplaining in action a little, but just a little, because I know it was cute and ironic, right?
It was adorable.
It was adorable.
The levels of irony are smothering, I would say, so far in this segment. But to get us back on track, since I'm nominally
the host,
mansplaining, in your view, is what?
It is a word that describes an interaction between men and women that's predicated on the sense that men have more knowledge and understanding that women could benefit from. An interaction that's predicated on a fundamental sense of, you need my help. And so that makes any kind of exchange or comeback cute rather than authoritative.
And how pervasive a problem would you say it is in contemporary culture?
I could answer that.
there's just so much we could do with this.
You know, I don't think it's a new problem in culture. I mean, my favorite example of it is from Uncle Tom's Cabin, which is a book basically written to deal with mansplaining about slavery. And there's a moment in it when the senator and Mrs. Byrd, who are, you know, is this kind of northern senator, his wife is saying to him, slavery is terrible because mothers and children. And the senator, who's been listening to all of these logical debates, kind of pats her on the shoulder and says, your feelings are so interesting, my dear, and I love you for them, right? And it's this sense of like, that's so cute, but I'm going to explain now to you the situation of what it's like to be a mother in slavery, because I know, because I have tumescent understanding and knowledge, right? And she's like, right? I mean, the exchange that we're having is characteristic of the subject, not only because of the tumescent mansplaining that you folks are demonstrating so helpfully, but because of my response, which is not to engage directly, but to go into humor and misdirection, which I find the workaround. Mm-hmm. That doesn't exactly answer your question, Lori. Do you find it to be a pervasive part?
Well, I find it to be very humorous and pervasive part. Can I tell my mansplaining story?
It's important to ask Tom for permission.
No, it doesn't have anything to do with Tom. Let's just say that. But I'll tell it. I'm talking to a guy. This was like 25 years ago in New York. And he's explaining his business to me. And by his business, I mean like his actual business. I'm not talking about his junk or anything. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what about blah, blah, blah? And there was a pause. And then he said, Lori, what you don't understand is that I understand all of it. He literally said that.
Well, one thing that we should say is that although the word didn't come from this 2008 Rebecca Solnit essay, Men Explain Things to Me, the concept kind of came from there. She explained a phenomenon that a word then jumped in to fill that void. It starts with a similar anecdote, and she's like, it's so great when something is so over the top and something that is otherwise very hard to name, which is this general sense of being condescended to, but is very hard to pinpoint, comes to the top, and everyone's like, oh, that was weird, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, because what the guy is doing is explaining her book to her.
Well, can we just recap? She's at a party, and she's at a party with a girlfriend, and they meet a guy, and so somehow Edward Muybridge comes up.
Because Rebecca Solnit had just written a book about
him. But the guy says, I just read this really important book about him. There's a really important book about him that you should know about. And she thinks to herself, that must be another book. It must not be my book. There must be some book that I missed. Because, and I have to say, I think that's a good thing about women.
Right.
That we, stop and think, maybe there's something I don't know.
One of the things that talking about mansplaining does is just really shut Seth and I right
up. It really did. After a while. It took a little while, but then it did.
But I will talk about, I will use this as an opportunity to invoke my daughter, who was relating a story to me about something that happened to her at the office. And she said, and then this guy started mansplaining to me. And I said, really, mansplaining? You know, we're going to be talking about that on the radio. Let me ask you something, I said to her. Is there any such thing as ladysplaining? And she thought about it for a second and said, yeah, ladysplaining is when you have to explain something twice because the dude you were explaining it to wasn't listening the first time. I want to throw that to you, Sarah, and ask you, is there a gendered thing, admittedly reductive, because clearly mansplaining is slightly reductive.
So here's what I would say about that. One is that... two things. First, there is a range of conversational topics upon which women will assume authority over men, often, like how to feed the children lunch or how to clean the kitchen, right? There's a way in which that can happen. So that's a similarity, but I think there's a categorical difference because woman-splaining never has actual structural power behind it in the way that man-splaining does. And I think that that's one thing that's sensitive about the term is that as a man, particularly as a white man, particularly as a straight-minded man, you cannot be trying to mansplain, and you structurally just come into every situation with all of this power. You're richer. You're going to be taken more seriously no matter what you say. You're going to live longer. And women can't have access to that ever.
So for the enlightened guy or the guy who's struggling toward enlightenment, how does that person approach those interactions? Is it immutable?
Yeah.
Nothing can be done.
No, I don't think that. I think listening can be done
and
I have
humility,
some ideas, but perhaps I don't need to share them. Like maybe we just don't actually need your ideas for right now.
For a minute.
Just for a minute. That's right now. But the other thing I wanted to say is I looked up this morning mansplaining in Urban Dictionary, and all of the top definitions are clearly written by men, and they're all very angry.
Yes.
So this is definition 2. A sexist term used by misandrist women to disrespect, belittle, and devalue the opinion of her male peers in an attempt to make herself appear smarter or better in comparison.
Oh my God, that's classic.
A word used by pseudo-intellectual feminists, e.g. ugly chicks and over 30 single moms with no chance in hell in getting a man in their own age, and insecure fat chicks or a combo of all three on the internet to justify their losing argument and or anti-male rhetoric.
Donald Trump.
It goes on and on and on. Right. So they, what was great about the original Rebecca Solnit essay is the way in which she links this kind of just like low-key domestic energy, personal energy, to this broader global system that is men feeling really angry about women speaking and sometimes just condescending to them and sometimes stoning them or killing them. The other person who comes to mind is Mary Beard, who is a famous classicist at Oxford, I believe. You know, I go back to the 19th century when I talk about it. She goes back to Rome, this like long silencing of women's voices. And there was a great New Yorker profile of her 2 years ago, I think, where she just starts reading the hate mail that she gets. And she got this email that sticks in my mind where somebody said to her, I want to cut off your head and rape it.
Yeah.
Right. And like this ultimate act of like making your brain something that I can fuck and silence. I hope you can edit that out. But I mean,
no.
Like this radical silencing that goes from these small acts of condescension to, in many parts of the world, still just like an impossibility to represent your own experience.
Sarah, you did very well.
Thank you, Lori.
Tom and Arnold, let's say
yeah,
that.
We're not going. Well, I would never. I would never say
positions.
That.
It would be so fucking patronizing.
That's so revealing, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's just like, and now I have to take care of you. Like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a death spiral.
It's a death spiral.
Thanks so much for coming in, Sarah, and explaining to us.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm Seth Greenland here with Tom Lutz and Lori Weiner here on the LARB Radio Hour 90.7 FM KPFK. We are lucky to have newly minted poet laureate of the United States of America, Juan Felipe Herrera, stop by to read a poem by Philip Levine.
This is Juan Felipe Herrera. I want to read a poem by Phil Levine from his book, Breath. And in a way, that's what Phil Levine was. He was the breath from the mind, the breath from the heart, and the breath from the body's spiritual emanations, the breath of hard work, and the breath of loyalty and truth and sincerity. and of direct talk. He was a great friend. He met me early on here in Fresno in 1990, and he was waiting for me at Chicano Studies and Latin American Studies program. And he was just there. I kind of came in all awkward and aardvarky, and he was smiling, and he said hello, and he extended his hand. And that's how we began. And we read together, and we joked on stage together, and he said, Juan Felipe, stop taking photographs while I'm reading. I said, yes, Phil. And I really loved him. All of us did, and do, and continue. Today and 2,000 years from now, the job is over. We stand under the trees, waiting to be told what to do. But the job is over. The darkness pours between the branches above. But the moon's not yet on its walk through the night sky trailed by stars. Suddenly a match flares. I see there are only us two, you and me, alone together in the great room of the night world, two laborers with nothing to do. So I lean to the little flame and light my lucky, and thank you, comrade. And again, we are in the dark. Let me now predict the future. 2,000 years from now, we two will be older, wiser, having escaped the fleeting incarnations of working men. We will have risen from the earth of southern Michigan through the tangled roots of Chinese elms or ancient rose bushes to take the tainted air into our leaves and send it back purified down the same trail we took to escape the dark. 2,000 years passed in a flash to shed no more light than a wooden match gave under the trees when you and I were lost kids, more scared than now, but warm, useless, with names and different faces.
Thank you, Juan Felipe Herrera, for reading that Philip Levine poem today and 2,000 years from now. Thanks to Nina Revor, LARB editor Sarah Messley. Thanks to Juan Felipe Herrera. Thanks to our producer and moral conscience, Jerry Gorin. Our production staff, Ernesto Arellano and Eric Webster. It's Eric's last day, and we want to say a special thank you to him for all he's done. Our apologies to BJ Novak. Once again, we ran out of time, but he said he'll come back next week.
This is really getting a little embarrassing, frankly.
I know. Somebody needs to talk to that guy.
And it's like the Bruno Kirby thing in Larry Sanders.
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
Like, this is like too much. We really have to have
I know, but this is real.
Next week, it's got